the beauty of compliance is that you create actually culture within the companies. But any culture needs to be nourished and shared and protected. And so it's our responsibility as legal and compliance to remind the company as a whole that the importance of compliance when you have this culture already functioning. I believe that most of the CEOs of big companies, they got it. They got the message and they're part of the message already. They're messengers of that area of the compliance and legal. But it's always important to remind everyone that compliance is there. And I think that what has changed, Mike, is that we were used to a compliance more like a policeman, yeah. You know what I mean? And not as a strategic business partner, you know, of the business. And I think that has changed.
Global companies face unprecedented risks and challenges in today's economy. To mitigate these legal and economic risks, companies are rapidly embracing and elevating the importance of robust ethics and compliance programs to promote positive corporate citizenship. On Corruption, Crime, and Compliance, you'll hear from industry leaders and insiders about how to create effective ethics and compliance programs that will mitigate risks and maximize financial performance. Here's your host, Michael Volkoff.
Welcome, everybody. This is Michael Volkoff and Daniela Melendez here with another episode of Corruption, Crime, and Compliance. And today we have a really special guest. We have Nicholas Garcia, who is the Vice President, Legal and Regional and Compliance Manager for LATAM and for Orica, which is a company that Daniela actually worked at before, a global company, which Nicholas will tell you about. But first off, Daniela, welcome. Nicholas, welcome, and we're so glad to have you here.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Daniela, for having me.
So let me give you just a little background on Nicholas, who is just an absolute consummate professional. He works at one of the world's leading mining and infrastructure solutions providers. They produce and supply explosives, blasting systems, specialty mining chemicals, geotechnical monitoring, and a whole lot of services, 10,000 employees globally and operations in 30 countries and offices in US, Europe, and Australia. And Nicholas is in Chile, right?
Yes, I'm based in Santiago.
And Nicholas is an attorney, a Chilean attorney who graduated from the Pontificia Universidad. Here goes my Spanish, you guys. Católica de Chile with a Master of Laws degree from Cornell University. Where my son went. And I had forgotten this about your career path. You were the general counsel for ENAP, the Chilean public company.
Yes.
In terms of that's crude oil and fuels and other things. So Nicholas has probably seen it all. Anyways, welcome so much and thank you for your time. We know you're busy. Orica's always got a lot of interesting issues to deal with, I'm sure. But if you can fill us in a little bit on sort of the perspective that you have on legal and compliance. And I don't want to lump, I'm going to use Latin America as a shorthand, but I don't think it's fair because each country has its own set of challenges and issues and trends. But what I think is really interesting is to see and to get your thoughts on as well is, you know, the growth of compliance in Latin America. It's becoming a bigger and bigger and bigger issue. So just to get your perspective on sort of the legal and compliance area.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Mike and Daniela, for having me. Yes, as you said, the VP Legal General Counsel for Orica LATAM and the Regional Compliance Manager for the Americas. So I deal on daily basis with two different systems, really, two legal systems that are completely different, which is the common law and the civil law. Common law in the United States and Canada and the civil law from Mexico and below. So it's very interesting to see the continents with these two systems. And within LATAM, as you said, do you have as many as compliance as countries do you have, you know? But the Brazilian right. system is one system. Then you have, I would say, Colombia, Peru, and Chile are very similar. Brazil is different. So it's not only one thing, one Latin America. And then within Brazil, you have like 17 Brazils because right. it's extremely large and extremely diverse. So yeah, about the role, I think compliance in Latin America really started because we have like corporate compliance, you know, at the beginning, I would say in early 2000. And then we start taking things seriously about 2010, and so on. And you can see that in LATAM happening. You know, I include Mexico in this as well, because right. culturally it's closer to LATAM. So yeah, you can see a clear start point from 2010 and so on. And it has changed increasingly over the years with a different kind of evolution depending on the country. Chile, for sure, has been increasing their compliance regulation, and companies, either national or international, within Chile and within LATAM as well, but I'm going to talk about Chile first, have been increasing regulation, I would say accuracy, and taking it more seriously in terms of companies really leaving the corporate compliance and leaving and getting into this culture of compliance in different kind of ways. The last one in Chile, we have a piece of legislation that is already published and it's in force, would incorporate like more than 200 economic and environmental crimes to the models of compliance, to the prevention of crime model of compliance in Chile, with criminal responsibilities, civil responsibilities, not only for the board of directors, but also for the executives. So I would say that in LATAM, that's the tendency right now, you know, to take it more seriously, to go further, go to the next level. And it's very good because you can see how the culture of compliance, ethical compliance, it's growing and evolving within LATAM. And if you go 15 years ago, it wasn't really the case. We used to have this paper compliance, you know, and now it's a serious thing. And you start noticing that it's a serious thing when you realize that actually there's a culture of compliance within the companies. So that's, I could say about LATAM, a very rapid evolution, although we start later compared to the US or Europe. I would say that now we have a very similar systems and very similar crimes associated to you. So we're very proud of that culture.
You mentioned one thing. You were saying that Chile, Colombia, and what was the other country have very similar cultures?
Peru.
And it's interesting you say that because I went to a conference probably 12 to 14 years ago in Colombia. It was packed. It was crowded. There were like 300 practitioners there, you know, to talk about the legal and compliance issues. And I was just amazed at the interest, and maybe it's professional interest, people trying to get into compliance or maybe diversifying their career. That's one remark I had to get your comment on in a second. The other thing I noticed in Chile and some of the countries, and people underestimate this, from the United States, is that antitrust enforcement is actually, some of the countries there, it's pretty robust. And you got to be careful about antitrust issues in certain countries in Latin America in particular, because there have been some pretty big prosecutions there. Chile had one, and I know Brazil does a lot on antitrust as well. But anyways, your thoughts first on the sort of Colombia. I've seen a lot of growth, and we get invited, Daniela was invited to a conference, annual conference of compliance people, you know, to come and speak.
You're right. You know, I mean, it used to be an area, you know, that even in the law firms in Latin America, it was not an area of practice, you know. It was like, oh, yeah, we do some compliance, you know, regulation. Now, if you look at the webpage and you meet with the law firms all across LATAM, they do have a special area of compliance, you know, 100% dedicated to that. But that's an indication. That's a strong indication that things have changed for good in our jurisdictions. You mentioned antitrust. Yes, for sure. And that's something that I tell North America all the time. We do have a very strict antitrust regulation here in Chile. In LATAM in general, we do have antitrust regulation, quite sophisticated. But in the case of Chile, it's extremely hard. And the penalties you can face, they're very similar to the ones in the United States. So it's not only a civil action, it's also the executives, the board, certainly, and the companies itself. And we have to understand that within LATAM, particularly Chile, is a small country. So it's very easy to incur in some of this conduct, you know, because it's a small market. So everyone knows each other. And the market is, you know, it's a narrow market. If you take different kind of economic sectors of Chile, there's a few competitors. So, of course, the authorities will watch out for sectorial associations, you know, which are very good, but that's the perfect place to concert any kind of these anti-competitive practices. So when you get into a small country, a small market, you have to be extremely aware, particularly if you have this strong piece of legislation that regulates antitrust in Chile. LATAM, I would say, has grown a lot on antitrust regulation. Colombia has a very strong regulation in place as well. Peru also. And Brazil is getting there. But it's interesting to see when you are in a regional position, how you can actually testimony the evolution of different kind of legislation in different kind of jurisdictions. So the idea in the compliance part, and particularly in Orica, we take care under the compliance umbrella of antitrust and competition law, then anti-bribery, and then, well, of course, sanctions, because as you mentioned earlier, we're present in more than 100 countries, you know, with operation in more than 30. So it's an issue for us, sanctions as well. And that's the three main areas that compliance in Orica works. And you can see the evolution in these three areas across LATAM.
You know what, Nicholas, I was going to ask you, though, it must be challenging because you can have operations where you may be involved, Orica may be involved, let's say, in different countries within Latin America. You have to take each local country's, you know, culture into effect, the laws that are into effect. You know, you could have operations in Argentina. You could have operations in Colombia. You have to be mindful of that in the way that you're doing, administering your compliance program. I guess it doesn't always translate, and maybe, and I don't mean that, you know, the language wise, I mean, translate into the culture. And also you mentioned civil law frameworks in civil law countries. And people, I think, forget about that. You know, how do you sort of integrate all that? Or how do you, you have to be aware of all of that.
Yes, you're so right, Mike. I think it's a challenge and it's a beautiful one. You need to be able to set a criteria, you know, a standard. And then, of course, for me, the fact that I study abroad, that was my first, I would say, gleam of getting a new system and how do you understand that system and that culture. So for me, Cornell was a big issue when I arrived there to study. And then I work in New York and in a law firm, and that was very challenging as well. So I think it's a personal way that you approach with respect to different cultures, with respect to different pieces of legislation. And when you take compliance, we do have an international standard in the case of bribery,
you're
for
a
instance.
Global company. You're a global company too.
Yeah, exactly. So for instance, the anti-bribery standard that we have is based on the FCPA from the US and the Anti-Bribery Act of the UK. And from then, from that standard, the international standard that we set, we take it in particular, the local legislations. Wow. But it's very interesting. I mean, you learn all the time. You will think from an outsider that, yeah, they probably have the same kind of culture and the same kind of legislation. It's not like that, really. We do have the same language. We do have a common base. And we all have, I would say, with the exception of the US and Canada, we all have the civil law system. So the main cornerstone are there. It's basically Roman law, so to speak.
That's, we love the Romans. My wife is Italian, so we love the Romans.
It's Roman. It's the French civil code of Napoleon. So the system is kind of the civil law system. You have these similar cornerstones, right? Our pillars. Then it's what you said, you know, then you have to get into the particular culture. It's not the same, the approach of a Colombian or Argentina or a Chilean. And then if you go to Brazil, but that's a whole new world, you know, starting by the fact that it's another language, it's Portuguese,
Portuguese,
right?
Nicolas,
so, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, but although the cultures are different, if a misconduct is identified in one of the countries in LATAM, doesn't that raise a red flag of the conduct that may be happening in other countries?
Absolutely, yeah.
In other words, if you find misconduct within your operations in one country, that raises risks for the other?
Yes, and this is something that Daniela has is so right on this. If I find a misconduct, for instance, in Peru, it's easy to, I will not say assume, but it raises a red flag in terms of, what about Colombia? What about Chile? You know, what about Mexico? Because the way of thinking and the way of conducting themselves is similar. We have this common base. With Americans, it's different. And if you see the emphasis of, for instance, if we take investigation, let's go to business conduct. Within compliance, You would say that in North America, particularly in Canada and US, the emphasis is put in antitrust. And if you move to down south, well, the emphasis is put in anti-bribery, mostly. There are different compliances emphasis depending on the region, depending on the country, and depending on the system as well. So it's a different approach. When you take or think on LATAM, it's not one LATAM. It's a lot of LATAMs.
It's a lot of, each carries its own culture and operations may be a little bit different, but let's just say misconduct is committed in similar manners. We don't see like a particular type of, you know, Chilean bribery.
Yeah.
It's all bribery, you know, in that sense. But
Exactly.
One other sort of more macro question I wanted to ask you is, with the sort of disruption in Venezuela that's been going on and, you know, the problems, sanctions, and things like that, have you noticed, is that having an impact on the Latin American countries and business operations in nearby, you know, like Colombia or nearby countries, or is it really affecting all of Latin America from your vantage point?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. You're right. I mean, the impact of the situation, so to speak, that we have in Venezuela. We used to be in Venezuela. We're not present in Venezuela anymore.
You had to get out, right? Orca doesn't have any operations there.
Yeah, no, it was very difficult to navigate. In Venezuela, I would say it's very difficult to get things done, you know, and it's, the economic situation is appalling. It's changing every year, but in general, it's not a good environment for doing business. Particularly if you want to be, as we want, in full compliance of sanctions, that was a challenge, a real challenge. So yeah, we left Venezuela last year, and the situation that happened on these days will have an impact. It's having an impact, you know, in the entire region. We have a lot of immigration across LATAM from Venezuela. So people are going out of the country and arriving in Peru, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, certainly Colombia, which is next to. And that creates a lot of issues, this massive immigration into our countries. I would say, of course, we speak Spanish. We always speak Spanish. We have the same cultural base. But when you have a massive immigration, as is the case, of course, it's quite a challenge to accommodate it. So now we already have like 2 to 3 immigration waves from Venezuela from the last 20 years. But we were certainly expecting another one with this current situation.
It's tragic to see it.
I have a question for Mike. Do you think how is the U.S. regulator going to react to the recent elections?
I think they're going to put in more strict sanctions. I mean, they relaxed them for a 6-month period based upon Maduro's promises with regard to the election, but he didn't keep his promises. So I think we're in for another tough time in Venezuela. Yeah. It's unfortunate because for years and years, America got a lot of its oil was coming from Venezuela. You know, so now this changes a whole lot of things. And, you know, it is really tragic to see what's going on in Caracas and all around the country. And the other thing I've read about, Daniela, is how what Nicholas is saying, that there are a lot of people leaving Venezuela, and a lot of them come right next door to Colombia. You know, I think that's probably the most popular place they go to. So
very interesting, too, is that next to it, next to Venezuela, is Guyana, right? Yeah. And the economic growth that Guyana has experienced for the last couple of years has been massive, with a lot of resources. So there are a lot of oil and gas companies, but also mining companies getting there. So it's expected to have a boom in terms of growth and development. So it's kind of tragic because you have Venezuela in this situation that we're discussing, and very next to it, you have Guyana, which is actually the opposite, right? Where all investment, foreign investment is coming in, you know, and you can actually see the development and the growth, as opposed to Venezuela, who naturally speaking is one of the richest countries in South America in terms of natural resources. But then you have this political chaos and you have this economic appalling situation that it has been for quite a while already.
Yeah. And Guyana is, you know, in the process of building even their state-owned infrastructure for how they're going to develop the mining resources, but most importantly, oil and gas, because they have incredible deposits. So I've seen with a lot of our clients now, And we were working with one client in particular with regard to Guyana. That was just all the big majors are going there. All the big companies are going there and investing.
It's true. It's very interconnected what you're saying, because, I mean, there is a zone between Venezuela and Guyana, which is actually a very dispute zone. And all this situation, political situation in Venezuela may have some repercussions. The Essequibo area, which is in the middle between Guyana, is in Guyana, but Venezuela claims to have rights to that land as well. So you have this, I would say, opposed interest, you know, Venezuela reclaiming this part of them and Guyana say no. And then in that zone, you have a lot of companies, foreign companies, right? With foreign investment companies. So I don't know. I think when you look at the subcontinent of LATAM, that part is very tragic. You have a political chaos in Venezuela and economic decay there with a lot of immigration to other LATAM countries. And then you have next to it, Guyana, which is booming and growing and developing. So it's very, it's like black and white, right?
Let me ask you another question. In terms of compliance and what you see in companies, can you sort of generalize a little bit, but on the leadership of companies, the CEOs, the C-suite, the CFOs, whatever, are people in compliance still educating leadership about the importance of compliance? Or do you find that the leadership has gotten the message?
At this time, most of them got the message, and it's part of the culture. I mean, that's the thing about culture. I'm legal and compliance. And I always think that the beauty of compliance is that you create actually culture within the companies. But any culture needs to be nourished and shared and protected. And so it's our responsibility as legal and compliance to remind the company as a whole that the importance of compliance when you have this culture already functioning. I believe that most of the CEOs of big companies, they got it. They got the message and they're part of the message already. They're messengers of that area of the compliance and legal. But it's always important to remind everyone that compliance is there. And I think that what has changed, Mike, is that we were used to a compliance more like a policeman, you know, you know what I mean? And not as a strategic business partner, you know, of the business. And I think that has changed, at least in my experience from INAP. I'm here in Orica. You can see that change. The business needs to see us as a strategic partner. We can help them to be not only successful, but more successful even, you know, by achieving their goals in compliance of all the compliance regulation in different countries, different kind of jurisdictions. And I think that that message, in the case of Orica, but I also believe in most of the big companies, that message has been passed. We are a strategic business partner more than the policeman that we used to
Nicholas,
be.
That is such an important point, because what we're seeing is that even the commercial people, the salespeople, we've encouraged people to, you know, when you're selling to somebody or trying to get them to buy your products and you say, look, we have a robust ethics and compliance culture, I think that makes you a more trustworthy business partner. You're a person of your word. You operate with integrity. So to the business, what I found is, one, it helps them to promote themselves if you have a good ethics and compliance program and you give them the ammunition they need, and sharing information. A lot of times you are looking across the whole organization, you know, the industry, and you may have important information to help the business given your perspective across the organization and everything. And so I think you're a natural partner, and because it's good to be involved in, let's say you're doing acquisitions, to be involved early and you can help them to navigate some of the issues that could slow them up later on. You know, you start from the beginning. And that's why it's important what you're saying, is that you're a business partner. You're not a sheriff, you know, and I've seen an evolution in that.
I also think that it's important that the chief compliance officer or the leader of the ethics and compliance team builds good relationship with the business. Otherwise, it gets very challenging to get to that point.
Right. You want them to pick up the phone and call you and not be afraid to call Nicholas and say, we have a question.
And that was my point. I think that from what I have seen, Nicholas built a very good relationship with the business, and that's why they are not afraid to call and ask for help.
I completely agree. I mean, as legal and particularly as compliance, you need to be persuasive. You need to build trust And you need to build relationships, and they need to understand from where you're coming. And when they see that you're coming here to help and to make them more successful, well, that's when the magic happens. I think that having a good, strong and trust-based relationship with the business is a key for our function. If a compliance officer or general counsel or VP legal or whatever name you have is relevant, you will be measured. Your success will be measured for that, for the quality of the relationship that you can achieve with your business. And that's why, if you think about it, that's something that needs to be imparted in the universities as the law school, right? The need to connect with people, the need to lead actually your team with that goal, the need to be empathetic to the goals of the business. They don't need someone that can say no to everything. You know,
exactly.
We need to be creative.
Yeah. I call that you don't want to be a Dr. No. Years ago, I was in Colombia, and when the chief compliance officer walked into the room, and, you know, the CEO was there and everybody was there, everybody said, uh-oh, the sheriff's here, like you said.
Yeah.
This is 15 years ago. And that to me is a bad sign. That's not a good sign. That means they view you as the enemy in a sense. And what I'd rather have them say is, oh, Nicholas, thanks for helping us solve that problem. That was great. We navigated that issue with your help.
And absolutely,
that is the important thing. Well, one other question, though, in Latin America, I wonder, and I don't know, I really don't have any feel for this issue, but do you find that people and employees, what's the speak up culture like in Latin America? Are people afraid to report things on the hotline? Are they more comfortable raising things with their bosses? Or do people generally stay silent, like culturally?
I think it has been, as compliance, an evolution, right? At the beginning, no one trusts any kind of system. The speak up, the hotline, it was like, how can I know that it's confidential? How can I know if I submit an anonymous claim, you know, it will remain anonymous, you know? It was a trust issue with the system. That was like 10, 15 years ago, even less, I would say 8 years ago. Now we are getting as a whole, as a subcontinent, as a region, and you can see it in the stats, that people generally, they're trusting more that actually is confidential. But it doesn't happen overnight, and you have to be able to provide assurances in terms of what, for instance. It was a huge problem in LATAM at the beginning, where investigations were not conducted on due process. So whatever the reason, you end up at court, the court dismissed the entire investigation because it was not in accordance with due process. Once that started to be corrected across LATAM, and I think there's different levels in different countries, it's a different evolution, but generally speaking, once the investigation started to be in accordance with due process, you get first more successful rates at court as an outcome. And second, you got people to trust the system because you provide assurances that the system actually works the way it says it works. Now, in my personal experience, I can tell you that you can see and you can feel the people are, you know, more confident and they have trust that the system, it is what it is. And the measures, when it comes to an unsubstantiated conclusion, the measures that says it's going to establish, they do. So it's about being coherent. And I think that's very important. I mean, it's not because you have a speak up system or a hotline system, automatically people will trust the system. You have to build that, right?
Yeah, I agree. And I just noticed that some countries, it's more difficult, but takes time. And you build trust through demonstrating that you protect the employee and that you are fair in the way that you handle the case and resolve it. And word gets out quickly, you know, word gets out quickly.
I think that in LATAM, employees are very afraid of, for example, retaliation. So once you show that there's no risk of retaliation, you may increase the rate of people coming forward.
What's interesting, Danielle, on that is the NAVEX recent study showed that anonymous reporting is increasing, where people report anonymously, but they're also getting higher substantiation rates. which makes me think that people are really concerned about retaliation, so they don't want to put their name out there. Yeah. But that's across the world, not just Latin America. But I think that the people who would normally report them and give your name, more of them are going anonymous for fear of retaliation. And I think there's still a big retaliation problem out there, to be honest with you.
It's something that, well, as any kind of system, it needs time to demonstrate that it is what they are saying it is. So we need to prove our denouncers or reporters that if they want to go public or they want to not be anonymous, no retaliation will be and no confidentiality will be breached, you know, by the team, which leads us to another issue that I think is very relevant on the matter. We need to have our business conduct teams. We need the best people there, you know, because you are dealing with very sensitive matters. So you need to have not only well-prepared lawyers, but people that can connect with a testimony, with witnesses, or the reporter in case he wants not to remain anonymous. And we can see it in different kind of companies in terms of the quality of the lawyers that they are dedicating their time to investigations is increasing. And I'm very fond of it. I think it's very important to have the best lawyers possible in charge of this system and the investigations to guarantee due process, respect of the no retaliation, as Daniela mentioned, and to provide assurances that this is a serious system and this is a serious investigation.
Well, Nicholas, thank you so much. This has been fascinating. We appreciate your time. If one of our listeners wants to contact you, they have follow-up questions, or they want to get some advice from you, what's the best way for people to reach you?
Oh, by LinkedIn or by my official email at Orica. I think you have it. But in LinkedIn, I'm Nicolas Garcia, Orica. Okay. They can reach me through that or directly to my email, nicolas.garciaorica.com.
Fantastic. Nicholas, thank you again. Muchas gracias. And have a great weekend. And we appreciate everything in your time. And thank you, Daniela, for helping to arrange this and support the podcast.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Daniela. It was a real pleasure and hope you have a great weekend too.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode, the best way to support the show is by subscribing on your favorite listening platform. To learn more and connect with Michael Volkov, go to volkovlaw.com.